From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today we hear an analysis of Proposal 2, the anti-gerrymandering ballot initiative.
The proponents of this, the voters, not politicians, wanted to get as far away from political involvement in this as they could.
We get the view of an LGBTQ civil rights organization on Bill Schuette's campaign claims.
He's looking for a loophole where religious institutions and perhaps even religious people are able to claim some sort of religious exemption from civil rights law.
Dustin Dwyer continues his series on the land. Today, that time when Michigan looked like a moonscape.
Most of Lower Michigan's forests were clear-cut during the logging era.
And we hear from the Democrat running against incumbent Justin Amash in Michigan's 3rd congressional district.
I have run into many Republicans that say they're going to vote down because they don't believe he's a solid Republican.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Gerrymandering. You've probably been hearing that term a lot lately. It means one political party has advantage over another political party by redrawing maps for legislative and congressional districts. Michigan is one of the most gerrymandered states in the U.S. This November, voters will decide on a ballot proposal that seeks to end gerrymandering in the state by creating a commission of citizens that would set district boundaries themselves.
Names will be drawn out of a hat saying these four people from the Republican Party, these four people who consider themselves Democrats, and these five people who say they're independent will be on the commission.
Later this hour, an analysis of Proposal 2. But first, some folks assume since the U.S. Supreme Court legalized gay marriage, LGBTQ legal discrimination is over. Let's move on. Well, the facts are these. In Michigan, you can be fired for being gay. You can be denied housing for being gay. You can be denied service for being gay. And if you're a trans person, you often can't even use the bathroom. Here to talk about some of those issues is the executive director of Equality Michigan, Steph White. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester.
So let's talk about politics a little bit. Last month, Founders Brewing Company used Twitter to indicate it was leaving the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce because the chamber's endorsement of Bill Schuette for governor. The tweet read, "We stand with our LGBT community and ask that the Grand Rapids Chamber reverse their decision." Then Founders reversed that position and said the employee who posted that tweet was not authorized to do it. Beer is nonpartisan. What do you make of all of that?
Well, it's great that we're having this discussion in West Michigan. I think that anytime we're talking about LGBT rights and how important we should make them in all of our decisions, whether commerce decisions or business decisions, that's good for LGBT people. I mean, that's been our position all along, which is that gay rights are nonpartisan and they impact the bottom line. So I will say this. We have a good relationship with the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce. They've been doing a lot of work to instill in businesses in West Michigan the idea that LGBT rights are important to their bottom line. And because of the work that they've been doing, a lot of businesses and their community have taken that very seriously. So people were surprised when they then endorsed Bill Schuette, a man who has made his political career on fighting against LGBT rights at every turn. And, you know, I don't know all of the dynamics that happen in Founders Brewing and in their decision making. But I do know that they are a strong ally of the LGBT community. And regardless of whether or not they stay in the Grand Rapids Chamber of Commerce or whether they pull out their membership, I think LGBT people and the people of West Michigan can be assured that Founders Brewing is a place where people can be hired and people can show up and buy their beer.
Let's talk about this presumption that Bill Schuette is against civil rights for LGBTQ people.
Sure.
Why is that?
Why do we make that assumption?
Yes.
Well, because at every turn he's taken an opportunity, when he's had an opportunity to take action, not just make a statement, but be active.
Give me a couple of examples.
So, for example, when a federal judge in the Sixth Circuit ruled that Michigan's ban on marriage equality was illegal and discriminatory, it opened up the opportunity for a few people to be married in a short period of time before the next level of court stepped in and said, no, we need to halt until a further decision was made. So in that brief window, there were 300 couples across the state of Michigan who were legally married. Then the state of Michigan decided not to recognize those marriages, and those couples sued. The state of Michigan was represented by Bill Schuette. He had the opportunity to either go ahead and accede their point and allow those marriages to be recognized and continue until the case wound through the court, or he had the opportunity to fight against those legal recognitions, and he chose to fight. And I should say, you know, his point that he says is, I'm just doing my job. I have to defend the Constitution and the will of the people. That's my job. But what he did was above and beyond. Instead of just fighting on legal grounds, he brought in some highly dubious characters into court to argue that gay people are inherently sick and introduce illness into society, a highly bigoted and discredited argument that was a very personal attack on gay people themselves. It had nothing to do with his job. So that's one example, you know, and he also took the opportunity to fight against our Michigan Civil Rights Commission decision. You alluded to, you know, the status of discrimination and whether gay people have protection or not in our state right now. In May of this year, the Civil Rights Commission ruled that LGBT people were actually protected under sex discrimination. And that is in keeping with the federal rulings of courts, including our own federal Sixth Circuit Court. So he also took that opportunity at that point to argue against that.
He issued an opinion.
He issued an opinion. Yeah, the state, some of the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate asked him for his opinion, and he issued it. And he is trying to use his opinion as if it has some sort of weight of law in this case. Fortunately, it does not.
After this founder's brouhaha, Schuette has said he wants to prohibit discrimination of any kind through the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act and protect constitutional religious freedoms. So what does that mean to you?
So what it means is he's looking for a loophole where religious institutions and perhaps even religious people are able to claim some sort of religious exemption from civil rights law. It is a discussion that we'll have. And first of all, let me just say this. It is fantastic, and it is a wonderful sign of our progress that Bill Schuette has had. It feels like he has to go on the record saying, yes, I will support gay rights in our state. You know, he puts an asterisk there with a caveat, and, you know, we'll see what that's really worth. But the fact that he can't ignore this issue anymore, and he can't just publicly demean our community and dismiss our claims of equality, I think that's a real step forward.
Recently, there was a couple of same-sex couples who filed lawsuit against the state. They say the state contracts with child placement agencies who refuse service to same-sex couples on religious grounds. And this has been a long simmering issue. I mean, I covered this pretty extensively several years ago. A judge has said the case can proceed. So how important is this particular case?
Well, that's huge. That really is. It's one of the, I think, you know, it's hard to rank all of the issues that impact our community, but I hear from people all of the time as I am around the state who are very hurt by this decision. It's incredibly bad for children, as the courts and all the agencies have stated. When we were first fighting about this issue, everyone agreed this isn't a decision that's in the best interest of the children. This is a decision to deny LGBT couples that's in the best interest of the religious institutions who want to be able to practice discrimination. So there's a couple of reasons why this is so important. Number one, it hurts children. There are children in foster care who deserve loving homes, and there are LGBT couples who are ready to adopt them and give them those homes. Number two, it's a question of whether our tax dollars can be used to discriminate against us. So as a taxpayer, I have to pay my taxes, and then those taxes are used and given through these contracts to these religious adoption agencies who then discriminate against me and other LGBT couples or other LGBT children.
I read a Detroit Free Press article last month about Ferndale businesses getting a hate letter in the mail condemning them for displaying rainbow flags. I imagine Equality Michigan gets its own share of hate mail for advocating for civil rights for LGBTQ folks. Is that kind of thing escalating because of the high passions surrounding this election year?
I have seen not an escalation in that kind of anonymous mail, but what's really scary is that we've seen an escalation in People who are blatant and not afraid and not shy about hiding behind a letter or, you know, anonymous mail.
So it's not covert anymore.
It's not covert anymore. That's right. We've seen a spike in hate crimes and hostility. We have a Department of Victim Services that reached about 400 clients last year, which is four times as many as we did about 3 or 4 years ago. So it's absolutely increased, and it is concerning to lots of us.
The Human Rights Campaign recently issued its Municipality Equality Index scorecards. 10 cities in Michigan were listed or ranked. Ann Arbor, East Lansing, Detroit, Ferndale, they all scored very high. In fact, Ann Arbor got a 100 out of 100. Traverse City, Grand Rapids, Lansing, and Kalamazoo scored quite well.
Yep.
A couple of cities in Michigan scored very low. On that scale of 100, Sterling Heights scored 20. Warren scored 14.
Right.
What are we to make of that?
Well, I will tell you that the cities that are scoring the highest are the ones that spend the time and the energy and the resources to improve their policies and will respond to us when we reach out to them. We actually, Equality Michigan reaches out to these cities every year and says, hey, you know, this scorecard's going to come out and it's going to reflect on you. Do you want some help? We'll be happy to work with you. You know, Sterling Heights and Warren always decline our offers and are not interested in working on this.
Because no gay people live or work there.
Yeah, it's surprising that that they don't place a high value on it. You know, it's not even about how big is your LGBT population in your city, but how do you want to be portrayed across the state and publicly? Is your city a place that's forward-thinking, that's looking to the future, that wants to attract young and creative and talented entrepreneurs? Or do you want to stay stuck in the, you know, 1950s and old dying industries and you know, just stay stuck where you are. I think that you see the cities that are focused on this are cities that are thriving and are very attractive places to live.
Steph White is the Executive Director of Equality Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
Coming up, the Democratic candidate in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District, Kathy Albro. She'll share what her priorities would be if elected. One of them is health care.
You know, repeal and replace every 3 or 4 years isn't what this country needs either. That's very expensive, and a lot of people are suffering because of it.
That's in 10 minutes. Stick around. This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In 1831, a young French writer arrives in Michigan, hoping to get a glimpse of untouched American wilderness. Alexis de Tocqueville sets out on horseback from Detroit to Saginaw with the help of native guides. They travel through dense virgin forests and swampland and finally emerge on the banks of the Saginaw River, where de Tocqueville reflects on the future of this land. He wrote, "In a few years, these impenetrable forests will have fallen. The noise of civilization and of industry will break the silence of Saginaw." He had no idea. For part three of his series, An Idea on the Land, Dustin Dwyer tells the story of how the forest of Michigan fell and built the state we know today.
I've been trying to hold a picture in my mind of what de Tocqueville must have seen. There are no pictures of Michigan before the trees fell. All we have are the words and maps left by the Europeans and their descendants. They tell of a land covered by ancient forests. In the southern half of Michigan, maple, beech, oak, hickory, ash, American chestnuts, too, giants that once spread across the eastern U.S. in groves with trunks 5 feet thick. American chestnuts are nearly extinct now, most of them killed off by blight. Up north, the trees were different. White pines and hemlocks with massive trunks that shot straight to the sky, branching only at the very top, 100 feet above ground. Today, there's only one place in lower Michigan where you can see a forest like that.
So we are about to walk into our old growth forest. We have the largest stand of old growth trees left in the lower peninsula.
Hillary Pine is a historian with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. She's showing me around Hartwick Pines State Park, just north of Grayling. And yes, Pine really is her last name. We're on a paved trail. The forest around us has the feeling of a cathedral. Tall columns, a high ceiling, a rare kind of calmness.
Unfortunately, today, there's only about 49 acres left. For those that don't know, most of Lower Michigan's forests were clear cut during the logging era. And that was about 1850 to 1910.
This logging era got underway just as the Erie Canal opened, and just as white settlers gained control of the land of Michigan from its indigenous people. These settlers and speculators saw opportunity in the trees. They called the white pine green gold. And it's not a stretch to say that the wealth created during the logging boom is what made Michigan possible today. The wealth in wood turned into other kinds of wealth. In 1858, a man named Henry Crapo moved from Boston to Flint to get into the lumber business. He made a bunch of money. So did his grandson, William Durant, the founder of General Motors. When Henry Ford launched his first car company in Detroit, the money came from William H. Murphy, another lumber baron. When Ford split from that company, Murphy stayed in the automobile business and renamed the company Cadillac. Michigan is the state that put the world on wheels, but the financing came from the forests. Hillary Pine says the result on the land was devastating.
And it's not something a lot of us think about, because a lot of us think about Michigan as having these beautiful big forests. And we don't necessarily think of the Michigan of 100 years ago that it was ugly. If you wanted to go on a road trip from Grand Rapids up to like Mackinac City, it was ugly, looked like a wasteland. There'd be tree stumps with their roots exposed because erosion was a big problem, and it was not a pretty place.
There are photos of this, barren landscapes strewn with branches tinted in sepia. The loggers didn't take everything. They left behind the smaller trees, the gnarled branches, the pine needles, just enough to set off massive wildfires. On October 8, 1871, the Great Lakes states were consumed with fire. Most of us have heard of that day because it's the day Chicago burned. But Chicago wasn't even the worst of it. One fire started in eastern Wisconsin and reached parts of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It's known today as the Peshtigo Fire, and it's still the deadliest wildfire in U.S. history. And there were other fires that day. An estimated 2.5 million acres across Michigan burned. And 10 years later, in 1881, the Thumb Fire burned another million acres. It killed more than 280 people and sent a plume of smoke all the way to the East Coast. The worst of these fires ended over a century ago, but the land of Michigan is still recovering.
This was a region-wide human, I don't want to call it a disaster, but a major disturbance.
Newt Nadelhofer is a biologist who studies forest ecology. He directs the University of Michigan Biological Station. It sits on about 100 acres of land along Douglas Lake on the northern tip of Lower Michigan.
You know, when visitors go up there, they think it's a beautiful, pristine place, but it's really sort of a early middle-aged forest in terms of forest life cycles.
Pretty much all the forests we see in northern Michigan are like that. Most of us can't tell the difference, but there is a difference. Younger forests have less diversity of plants and animals, Nadelhofer says.
We have a much simpler and younger forest on average.
But we do have a forest. That's because 100 years ago, after the forests were destroyed, the soil washed out, the remains sent up in apocalyptic flames, the people of Michigan had a change of mind. The clear-cutting stopped. Eventually, a massive effort began to replant the trees. The Civilian Conservation Corps went acre by acre, planting millions of trees. Today, the trees have grown tall, and you can still spot them in stretches of forest where pine trees grow in perfect rows. And a few people acted to save the forests that still stood. People like Karen Hartwick, who saved Hartwick Pines.
She's from Grayling. She grew up knowing that this old growth forest was here.
Hillary Pine tells me the story back on the old growth trail at the state park. Karen Hartwick was born Karen Mickelson, the daughter of a lumber baron. Pine says in high school, Karen meets Edward Hartwick, and they eventually marry. Hartwick gets into the lumber business too, but when World War I breaks out, He goes to Europe to serve his country. He never comes back. In her grief, Karen decides to make him a memorial. But it wouldn't be another statue or a plaque. She wants to memorialize him in land. Then Pine says Karen Hartwick discovers her father's lumber company still owns an 8,000-acre patch of land near Grayling, and part of that land had never been logged. It was a small part, not worth the effort of setting up an entirely new operation to bring the trees down. The lumber company doesn't want it anymore.
They have been trying to sell it to the state of Michigan, and the state will not buy it. So Karen swoops in, she buys it. In today's money, she pays about $600,000 for it, for 8,000 acres, and she immediately the next day gives it to the state.
She gives it with some stipulations. She says the trees here can't be touched. Nothing can be harvested. If a tree gets a blight, the blight stays until the tree falls. And when the tree falls, the log stays there and rots, just like trees used to do. That log becomes a refuge for bugs, mushrooms, small mammals. Trees support life long after they die. And why does all this matter for us today? Because our ideas about forests, our ideas about land, they last long after we're gone. The early white settlers of Michigan had certain ideas. Karen Hartwick had certain ideas. Their ideas are still playing out on the land more than a century later. The ideas we have about land and water will play out for centuries after we're gone. And these ideas, they're never really just about land. They're not about forests or trees or little squirrels living in dead logs. They're ideas that affect people. And the consequences for people can last a long time too.
Tomorrow, Dustin Dwyer will bring us the final story in his series, An Idea on the Land, the lasting legacy of the Burt Lake burnout. That's tomorrow on Stateside. We've been working to bring you interviews with statewide and congressional candidates before Election Day. Today, we're talking with the Democratic candidate in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District, Kathy Albro. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, Lester. I really appreciate this opportunity.
You're challenging Republican Justin Amash, the incumbent. Why do you want to replace him?
Many, many, many reasons. But first of all, I and many, many others in this district believe that he has not done the job for 8 years representing us, and I think I can do a much better job.
He is not a typical Republican. He sometimes butts heads with the Republican leadership and the Trump administration. How does that affect how you're running against him?
I don't think it has at all, actually. I would run the same campaign if he was a strong Republican, I believe, too. I have run into many Republicans that say they're going to vote Dem because they don't believe he's a solid Republican. So I think maybe that's helping me a little bit.
How do you describe your political leanings?
I would say, and I don't like to label, because I think that we should be looking at people's values and the way they believe issues, policy should go. So I would say that I'm a progressive, if you wanted to put a label on it.
So we'll drop that for a second and try less to label you and find out what your issues are. What are your top three priorities if you were elected to represent the 3rd District?
Well, what I'm hearing most, and I think this is all around the country, but definitely in this district, I hear people all the time talk about health care. And, you know, Obamacare has helped many people, but we also have a lot of people that do not have health care or that are very underinsured and need to come up with a lot of funds in order to have the kind of health care that they need. So I hope that we have a majority in Congress. I don't care if they're Republican, Democrat, or independent, or whatever. I just hope we have a majority that wants to work on this problem and solve it for good, because, you know, repeal and replace every 3 or 4 years isn't what this country needs either. That's very expensive, and a lot of people are suffering because of it.
What do you think the answer is?
I agree with single payer, unless somebody can come up with a better idea, but I've done some research into what's going on in Canada and other countries that have a successful single-payer system. And I know that we probably can't do it exactly like other countries, but I definitely think that we can save money by not having the bureaucratic layer of insurance companies taking their profits and their CEO pay and all the marketing and all the other things that they need to pay for. I believe that we can negotiate lower pharmaceutical prices because we'll have a much broader base of people. And I also think we should standardize medical procedures. I read about in Wisconsin, they did some research where a typical knee replacement is $50,000, and somebody did 18 months of research trying to track real costs down, and they found that an actual cost for a knee replacement is $10,500. So that's just one example. We need to look into that. I've also read that some research was done at Grand Valley and that many medical procedures here in West Michigan are 30% higher than they are in the Detroit area. So why is that? Again, we need to come to the bottom of these things, and I think we can save some money.
Okay, so healthcare, one of your top three priorities. What's
right.
another?
So I was a teacher, and I also worked with teachers all over the country to help them develop active learning curriculum, getting their children out of the classrooms and into projects in the community. And what I discovered is that many children who deserve the most get the least. So equity in education is something that I believe the Department of Education should hold states accountable for. And Michigan is not one of those states that has policy to make sure that every child in the state has an equitable education. That means that they get what they need to succeed.
Okay. Equitable education, healthcare. Now you get a number three. What's that?
All right. Well, you know, there's so many things. The list is about 100 long, but I guess the next one would be an economic equality as well. I think we have two different economies in this country, one for the affluent, the investor class, and one for the people who are living paycheck to paycheck. And that's 60 to 70% of the people in this country. And I don't think they're being represented right now in this district. People want a change. And, you know, they're really suffering with this economy, even though many people say it's doing well. That's not true.
You have not held elected office before. How valuable do you think political experience is?
Well, I think it is somewhat valuable, but I really believe life experience is even more valuable. My opponent went into politics fresh out of law school, so I do not have a law degree, which probably would help, but I do have an education degree, early childhood specialty. I have life experiences as a teacher and a teacher educator. I also owned a couple small businesses here in Grand Rapids. 15 years, I owned an early childhood center called Creative Learning, and then a toy store to help subsidize that center for 30 years called Creative Learning Toys. I also work for a nonprofit, the High Scope Educational Research Foundation, as their director of elementary education. So I'm you know, familiar with nonprofits. So I really feel like I have vast life experiences that have shown me many ways of life and the way that the problems that this country faces and this district faces.
I read on your website that during the Great Recession, you lost your businesses and your home. Tell me what that taught you.
Right. Well, my husband and I invested in commercial real estate, and that it wasn't the businesses that did well, that didn't do well. It was that, you know, for we were tired of paying rent, so we ended up purchasing commercial property. And then when we expanded or I sold the school, we were landlords. So those businesses went out of business in about 2010. So we lost that income and were not able, that was like $10,000 a month in income we were receiving. So we were not able to make that up to pay the mortgages. In addition, the property values actually decreased by more than half from 2007 to 2011. So we really had no other option but to file for bankruptcy, and we had to liquidate the toy store. We lost every single piece of property, including our home. So what it taught me, actually, you know, I'm not disappointed that we went through this, because it taught me that, and I think I felt this all through my life, but that there are certain things that are way more important than money. As long as we have a basic income to be able to live, to pay the expenses for a simple life, it makes me happy and I feel successful. And we've had to lift ourselves back up. Fortunately, we both had good jobs, so we were able to lift ourselves up quickly, and we also were able to maintain our retirement income, so that helped.
As we both alluded to, Michigan's 3rd Congressional District is pretty solidly Republican. What's the message you want voters in the 3rd District to understand you, a progressive, as you labeled yourself, in a Republican district?
Well, actually, the Cook Report just came out and said that it's not a solid Republican district anymore. It's likely Republican. So that was good news for us. I mean, we still have a ways to go. I believe that the demographics in this district have changed since the 2016 election in many ways. First of all, I think more people are going to come out to vote, and especially more Democrats. That I've been talking to people all over the district for the last year, so I see that this is swinging. I also believe many young people that are just new voters are getting fired up to vote, and most of them that I've talked with are Democrats. And then the other thing that's happening is as I go door to door, I talk to people, and we're trying to hit some Republican doors, especially women, and sometimes they'll whisper it to me, but they have decided to vote Democrat too because they're really tired of how women are being treated in the Republican Party. So I have hope that this is not a solid Republican district anymore.
Kathy Albrow is the Democratic candidate running to represent Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. Thanks for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you, Lester.
We reached out to Albrow's opponent, Republican Congressman Justin Amash, for an interview. His campaign declined our request. Up next, what you need to know about the proposal to end gerrymandering in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Election Day is just around the corner. There are 3 statewide proposals on the ballot, and today we're going to review Proposal 2, which would change how the maps for legislative and congressional districts are drawn. Joining us now is Eric Lufer. He's the president of Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Welcome back.
Thanks, Lester. Good to be back.
So let's start with, how do we draw these different districts now?
Since the 1980s, the responsibility has been given to the legislature to do this. Our Constitution says we should have an independent commission, but for a number of reasons that was made invalid, and the court said from here on the legislature should do it and the governor has to approve it.
So what concerns are there when the party in power draws the maps of the state House and Senate and the congressional districts?
So if you have split legislature, if you have legislature of one party and a governor of the other, there's sort of a check and balance that you know you have to get approval, enough votes to get this through and the governor to sign it. But what we've had for the last couple sessions, Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican governor, they've been able to pretty much do what they want. The controls, this criteria that were put in the Constitution were thrown out with that independent commission. The courts told the legislature, you decide what the criteria should be, and the end result is gerrymandering. The end result is creating districts that are very safe for Republican candidates, will maximize the number of votes, and we've seen the results of that. A very Republican congressional team coming from Michigan, continuation of Republican control in the House and the Senate.
We've seen reports from Bridge Magazine recently that indicate the last redistricting, done almost 10 years ago, was done in secret, paid for by a group headed by people affiliated with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, making sure that the Republican incumbents were in safe districts. Why might that be a concern? I mean, politics is politics. This is the most partisan thing there is, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right with that, that this is perhaps one of the most political exercises that our elected bodies go through. But part of what we've come to expect in Michigan and I think sort of nationwide is some transparency, some sunshine upon the acts of our policymakers. So we don't expect laws to be made in back rooms anymore. We want them discussed on the floor of the legislature and we can listen and have our media talk about what they heard and have some open meetings. And also the freedom of information. If policy is being developed, we want to be able to go back and look at what the communications were, what process went into this. To have this all happen in secret runs very contrary to all those other ideas of sunshine that we expect in lawmaking.
So this proposal too, what kind of transparency does it call for?
A great deal of transparency. It says that all meetings of this independent commission that would be created are subject to open meetings, and that all communications between commissioners, between the public and those commissioners, all work product of the commissioners, including consultants that are hired to carry this out, would be subject to the freedom of information, and we would all be able to see exactly what goes into making the districts for the people that were represent us.
This independent commission that you mentioned, we had a listener call in to ask.
My name is Christine. I am curious how the people who would serve on this committee will be chosen. Will they be voted? Will they be appointed? Will they volunteer? Just how is it going to be decided?
So how does this independent commission, how is it put together?
It will be a very random process. The Secretary of State will develop an application. We suspect that'll be a very rudimentary application, name, address, some indication that you're an eligible voter, and some indication of whether you associate with the Republican Democratic Party or consider yourself an independent, which could mean that you affiliate with a different party. That application will be mailed to a number of potential commissioners, some people that they sort of randomly, are you interested in serving on this? It'll also be available on the Secretary of State website for people to come and self-say, you know, sort of raise their own hand, I want to be part of this process. All those names will go into three different buckets, Republican, Democratic, and Independent. And through a sort of convoluted process, names will be drawn out of a hat saying these four people from the Republican Party, these four people who consider themselves Democrats, and these five people who say they're independent will be on the commission.
Yeah, we actually had a question about that as well.
Hi, this is Josh in Grand Rapids. And what I'm wondering is, what's going to stop these independent voting commissions from being infiltrated by partisan people?
Okay, so they self-identify as Republican or Democrat or independent. Can we verify that?
No, we can't. So anybody who's participated in the primary in Michigan knows that you walk in and you can choose which party you want to vote in the primary system. We don't have a system in some other states where you say I'm a R, a D, or
you declare
or anything else. So it'll be up to the people, and you're signing your name to this, so you're attesting that this is what you do. How people are held to that is sort of unknown at this point. Part of this process, though, is to sort of weed out the obvious ones. Once you have those three different buckets I talked about, our political leadership in the House and the Senate, the Speaker of the House, the Minority Leader from the House, Majority Leader in the Senate, and Minority Leader will each have five, you know, sort of vetoes to go through that list and say, I know that Joe Blow is a practicing Republican. I don't want them in that Democratic pool. Or, you know, some other person is listed as an independent. They're very strongly an R or a D. So you'll be able to pull out a number of names and sort of do this, sort of limit the ability to game the system. What we see in the other states, Arizona and California, have more applicants than spots by far. So even though you might say, I'm going to put my name in and try to game that system, there's still a chance that you won't be randomly selected.
So I want to make sure I follow this right. The Secretary of State will randomly choose out of these three buckets you're talking about, Republican, Democrat, Independent, the number of from each that she's supposed to or he's supposed to, and then of those 13, the majority leaders, minority leaders of the House and Senate say, nope, 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 not that person. They're out, and they get up to five.
Five each, yeah.
Right.
So it sort of gets real complicated. So let's say you got 500 nominees. The first step is to get them down to 200. So you'll randomly pick 60 R's, 60 D's, and then 80 I's. And from that, there's the ability to sort of, with the voir dire in the court system, the jury selection, it's the same sort of thing. I don't want those people in that pool.
Yeah.
So it happens before the 13, but it's the same sort of process.
One of the complaints of opponents of Proposal 2 is that just because you're related to a politician, that should not eliminate you from being eligible to be on the commission. They say that's discrimination. Is that a concern? Is that something that Proposal 2 does?
So, yeah, to some extent, it's sort of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. A lot of times people related to politicians are paying more attention to what's going on and maybe more in tune. But it seems to me the proponents of this, the voters, not politicians, when they were putting this together, wanted to get as far away from political involvement in this as they could. So maybe going too far, but rationally doing it that way, I guess.
The group behind Proposal 2 is called Voters Not Politicians. If these independent commission members have no official political experience and basically have no familial connection to it, how will they have the expertise to put these maps together? We had one listener specifically ask this question.
Is there some sort of guiding principle that the new commission will have to follow? In other words, is there some way of ensuring that the new districts will follow natural, cultural, and geographic boundaries that actually make sense as opposed to being designed on political priorities?
And there are some federal requirements, right? I mean, the voters, minority votes have to be protected. There has to be some consideration given to cohesive regions. But besides the federal stuff, is there any other guidelines about how these should be drawn?
Yeah. So first of all, the beginning of your question was, will these people know what they're doing?
Right. Yes,
and,
it was.
And I would respond to that. We have term limits in Michigan. When we do this in 2021, everyone who took part in 2011 will have been gone. So we sort of built in a freshman team to do this every 10 years, whether we like it or not. The second part of your question are the criteria to be used. And the law, the proposal, the constitutional amendment, offers a number of different criteria that should be used, and it sort of rank orders votes them. So a lot of times you can't do both things. What do you choose? And then it ends up in court. Well, they said this is to be done in rank order. So it starts with the equal population that is part of the federal requirement, the Voting Rights Act, again, part of the federal requirements. But then it says let's make sure they're contiguous. You can't have part here and part over there with a bunch of space in between. They have to be contiguous. They're supposed to consider diverse populations and communities of interest. What that means is not clear, but it's up to the people to tell the commission, this is our community of interest and we want to stay together to have a political voice. To not provide disproportionate advantage to a political party or to a candidate, and then make sure they consider political boundaries, so let's try to keep cities and townships together and be as reasonably compact as they should. So all those things don't fit together, but the commission is supposed to rank order, you know, in that order, go through them.
Let me go back to my earlier question about expertise. Are they allowed to hire consultants or people to help them do this? You know, it sounds like somebody with some software knowledge might be important in this.
Yes,
to figure it out.
It'll be very important. And yes, they will hire consultants. They will bring in the people that know how to run the software and sort of understand all the science behind this. Now, that person has to be agreeable to everyone. So we talked before that the State Chamber of Commerce were sort of guiding that before. That's not going to happen.
They'll deny that, by the way. They'll say that they're not affiliated with that group. Just some of their executive officers are, not executive officers.
Neither the chamber nor any other special interest will be able to direct this going forward.
So if these are randomly chosen and we get the 13 and they're who they're supposed to be, who holds them accountable?
They hold each other accountable. There's very little opportunity for us to watch and say, I don't like what the commissioner's doing.
Let's recall them
or anything like that. So it really falls to the commission itself to say this person is erratic and is hard to work with. But it takes a really high supermajority. It takes 10 votes out of that 13 to get that person removed, so that almost unanimity that this is too hard to work with. Now, if the person becomes ill, the person can't participate, there's provisions for that as well that maybe wouldn't have the same high standard. You would suspect somebody in that situation would resign anyways.
What if this independent commission cannot come to an agreement on the map? You talk about that ranking, but that still doesn't get to agreement.
No, it doesn't get to agreement. And this is where it gets interesting from sort of a political science perspective watching this, that it introduces some game theory to the whole thing. So there's three different processes for decision making. The first one is just ask, can you agree on anything here? Now, we know we've got the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other, so the chances of them maybe agreeing on anything are not the greatest to begin with. Assuming they can't get along there, then they have rank order voting. So if you have five different plans and the commissioners rank order those to say, I like this one best, this one second best, third best, fourth, fifth best. So what we see when that's used in other places, it pushes people towards consensus. It pushes the parties to think about that. And the third option is just random selection. Now, you think about that. You can't, if that consensus building doesn't work, you could be left with your worst option. As a Republican, there's always that chance that you reach in the bucket, pull out the ping pong ball that says the Democratic plan is the one that'll be adopted. So it'll be in everyone's best interest to not let it get to the third option to figure out how to make it work with just plain decision-making or that rank order voting. So even though the first plan might not give you everything you want, maybe that second or third plan is agreeable enough that you can go for that.
Another concern is the cost of this redistricting process. Much of the cost last time was paid for by this secret group. Or I guess the group isn't secret, but it was secretly done at the time. Why is the cost a concern?
Well, I think it's a question of before and after. We all are concerned about the taxes we're paying, and given that this would be an escalation of cost, there's that. But then the counterargument is, how much is democracy worth to you? So it would set aside a quarter of the amount of what the Secretary of State gets out of the general fund now, about $4.5 million per year. This isn't for 10 years. This is really just the 2 years that they would be doing their work. It says that the commissioners would earn a quarter of what the governor makes, and that's about $40,000 a year, as opposed to just having the legislature doing it. We're paying for that to begin with. Assuming this is done in the open, then we're paying for the consultants and that sort of thing. So it is an additional cost, but, you know, again, go back to that question, what is democracy worth to you? Is it worth paying for that? And in the big picture of everything we spend money on, that is not that much.
I got one more quick question for you. This would be an amendment to the state constitution, which makes it very difficult to change. But what happens if we find that this system needs to be tweaked a little?
So we have to amend the constitution again. That can happen either by the legislature recognizing what's going on and offering an amendment, or through another petition process where you have to collect a number of signatures, have that verified by the Board of State Canvassers. Either route leads to a vote. People have to vote on that and change it that way. We could have a constitutional convention to look at the whole document. That happens every 16 years, and so far the people have said, we sort of like what we have. We're not interested in that.
Eric Lufer is the president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. You can find the Proposal 2 analysis at crcmich.org. That's crcmich.org. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks again for having me.
Here at Stateside, we like to hear from you. What stories are you thinking about? What issues do you think we should cover? Let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio, and at michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. And listen to Morning Edition in Stateside over the next 2 days to hear from the candidates for Attorney General. Morning Edition host Doug Tribou will kick off things tomorrow with Democrat candidate Dana Nessel. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Lindsay Scullin, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Sarah Leeson, Natalie Brennan, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.